Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/Choral Chihuahua. On with the ep.
It's time for Choral Chihuahua. Today is something a little different. Robert's not here, but I'm delighted to be joined by our great friend and colleague, the tenor Nicholas Mulroy. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Eamon. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very nice to be here. You've invited me to Mulroy Towers. So here we are, sat by your piano in your front room. And we're going to be talking about Bach and specifically his two passions.
That's right. The two surviving versions of the passion narrative that that we have, the St. John and the St. Matthew. Hoping to talk a little bit around the ideas that are contained in there. There's an awful lot to discuss, but we'll try and scratch the surface a bit.
Yeah, bring your long experience and our mutual love and enthusiasm for these works. And for the examples that we're going to be playing, we're going to be using recordings that that we both feature on to a greater or lesser degree.
That's right. The John and the Matthew, both recorded by Dunedin with John Butt, and yours is a particular a version from your student connection.
Yeah, indeed. So the recording of the John Passion made by Edward Higginbottom and the choir of New College, Oxford. Interestingly, this was a recording where all the vocal parts were sung by either present or former members of the choir. So that's with boys on the top line and, interestingly, a treble soloist singing what would traditionally be the soprano arias, but with fairly large-scale choral forces as opposed to Dunedin's, which was small
scale. We just do both pieces with just eight singers, which is just a different way of doing it, really.
Let's get straight into it with the opening chorus of the St. John.
Thank you.
the unmistakable opening to Bach's St. John Passion, performed there by the Dunedin Consort, directed by John Butt. Nick, my first experience of Bach was the St. John Passion. I mean, pretty much. I once played second flute in the second orchestra in a performance of the St. Matthew Passion in Bromley when I was about 16. But other than that, it was doing the St. John Passion with Edward Higginbottom. How's this for entitled luxury on an Australia tour? 2 weeks away with the Australian Chamber Orchestra in 1994. And that was where that was when I learnt the piece, was the first time doing the St. John Passion in Sydney Opera House.
Amazing. What a thing to be part of. Right?
It was extraordinary. I can still see the upbeat that Edward Higginbottom gave for that first performance. It was like it went through his entire body. It was one of the most inspirational things I'd ever seen, not to sound too precious about it. But that opening chorus has got such drive, it foreshadows everything that's going to come in the whole of the next 2 hours, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's an incredibly dramatic, kind of arresting thing to hear, isn't it? You wonder what they might have made of it in 1725, whenever it was, that version was first performed. Word seems to be that they didn't really like it. They thought it was too dramatic and too operatic and a little bit outside the frame of what church music should be.
Well, you can see where they're coming from with that. And that performance by the Dunedins there, I mean, that kind of grabs you by the collar, doesn't it?
Yeah, so we recorded it, it's actually, I think, 10 years ago now, and John put it in the context of the liturgy of the time, as kind of close to that as we could make it. On the disc, it comes out of a Buxtehude organ prelude, which finishes on D major. So it's this kind of ginormous, perfect cadence into the G minor beginning of the piece. So it's in context, but also kind of you therefore feel the kind of drama ratcheted up straight away by the presence of this music. Yeah, it's quite a thing.
Let's just have a listen to a slightly different approach. I mentioned Edward Higginbottom there. This is a recording which he made, over 20 years ago now, I think. Maybe about 20 years ago. A different approach, something which is more brooding, a bit more sort of coming from a distance, like a foreshadowing, I've used that word already, but it is it's less immediately present and less immediately dramatic. Edward Higginbottom there directing a recording with the choir of New College Oxford, and a greater focus on the oboes there. They're more to the fore.
Yeah, it's that spacious tempo allows more kind of wailing in the oboes. It feels like those incredible dissonances feel much more painful somehow. This, we never know what things mean, of course, but there's one, you know, those semitones between the woodwind could be the nails in the cross, kind of, as you say, foreshadowed.
Yeah, that's exactly what he used to describe them as.
Yeah. Achievement unlocked.
Yeah, but there's a lyrical quality to it, but an expressive quality that really speaks of the narrative that's to come.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Nothing's right or wrong. It feels like there's lots of ways you could do, you know, such fabulous music, but it just allows a bit more space to hear that extraordinary harmony, the swirling of the strings, the kind of insistence of the bass pedal is really, really nice. John's version, the Dunedin one, is much more kind of between the eyes, kind of inexorable, which is part of the construction of the piece, really, this sense that this is something that is preordained. But they both, I think both versions play into this slightly unexpected side of the music, which is that the text is, if we read the text on its own, it's praise and glory, and it's kind of D major trumpets and drums, like Christmas Oratorio. Contrast that with the music that he sets it to, and you've got a sense that this, what's the Herr unser Herrscher, Lord our Master, or our Ruler. So the words are glorious, but the music is full of suffering, and it's through the suffering that Jesus attains kind of divinity in Johannine Gospel.
Let's just rewind a little bit here. So we're going to be talking about the Passions today. In a nutshell, what are they?
What we're talking about today is Bach's two surviving settings of the narrative of Christ's trial, suffering, and death. I think it's in lots of ways it feels like the most important music Bach wrote. Certainly it belongs to a long tradition of singing the Passion narrative on Palm Sunday and Good Friday in the church. And what Bach is able to do is develop that tradition into something really, really way beyond where it had been even 20 years previous to that.
Yeah, and the tradition of singing the Passion narrative, you know, it comes from originally a sort of with plain song settings, with, you know, those occasional sort of tuba choruses, which is done in simple homophonic settings. And I mean, I can remember, you know, being in church choirs in years gone by and singing those settings. One memorable occasion when the priest, with the roles, you know, the characters within the story of Pilate and Christ and various others, sung by various members of the clergy, and the surprise which was levelled at the choir when Pilate was intoned in a rather sweet sort of fluty countertenor by one of the priests, finishing with the immortal phrase of quod scripsi scripsi, quod scripsi scripsi, which still rings in my mind. Yeah. You know, every year.
So the people like Bird and Lassus and Victoria set the Passion mostly to plain song, like you say, with harmonic interjections from the crowd. And so we have this sense that this is a story that belongs to singing, and also different levels of singing in every sense happen according to which character is speaking, which I think is something that Bach again really keys into.
Tied together in the role of the evangelist who narrates the story. And Bach gives this, I mean, you know, by comparison, it seems a very big step to move, you know, from Schütz to the degree of colour and drama that Bach gives to the evangelist alone, never mind what comes, you know, in the choruses as well.
I think that's right. He's able to kind of adopt or co-opt operatic conventions. So when a musician in the 18th century would have seen the word recit, they would have associated that, I think, with the theatre. So like you say, it's much more dramatic. For me, as someone who comes to that role to sing it, the evangelist is much more a real character. There's much less humanity or subjectivity in plain song, whereas the music Bach sets is very harmonically daring. It's very angular. It's very human in that sense, and so you're asked to do kind of several jobs. Really, you tell the story, but there's also poetry and there's also you know, fabulous musical content in there, which I think it's really worth kind of digging into a bit. Und sprach, ich bin's nicht, spricht der Sohn Priester.
Christus Knecht meiner, ein Gefreunter des dem Petrus das Ohr abgehauen hatte, sah ich dich nicht im Garten bei ihm. Da verleugnete Petrus abermal, und also bald krähte der Hahn. Da gedachte Petrus an die Worte Jesu und ging hinaus und weinete bitterlich und
co-pilot today, Nicholas Mulroy. No, you don't like co-pilot.
Well, his pilot comes in later.
Oh, yeah. My co-pilot today, Nicholas Mulroy, tenor as the evangelist, with Peter, sung by Robert Davis, and tenor Stephen Chambers singing Servus on the Dunedin Consort recording. Nick, that really exemplifies there the role of the evangelist, as you said, that both progressing the narrative, but then also singing, you know, presenting the poetry of the text as well, and the way Bach paints it.
That's it, exactly right. It's where he chooses to kind of foreground music, I suppose, as a subject of meaning and a place where the listener can understand not just the narrative, but also the perhaps the emotion or the psychology behind narrative. There's an awful lot in that, in that short space of time. The bass line underneath the Peter weeping bitterly after he realizes he's betrayed Christ. The bass line then becomes the material for the crowd scene in the next scene when they shout to Pilate, if this man weren't an evildoer, we would put him to death. This chromatic, yeah, ba, 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 that becomes then the thing that puts Jesus to death. So we have this sense of kind of, I suppose, causality, cause and effect, made explicit in the music, although, you know, listeners might not have got that immediately, perhaps.
These works are littered with these kind of associations, aren't there? And I don't know, maybe this isn't the time to go into that in too much detail. But the complexity and invention of thought that clearly went into this, you know, is mind-bending, isn't it?
It's amazing. I mean, we think of Bach as a mind, first and foremost, and I think in some ways that's not totally representative of what his music does, because I find the more I know the music, the more heart and soul and humanity there is in it, and even compassion. But at the same time, the kind of the mathematics of it are incredible. The way he threads musical ideas through both of these pieces to make kind of psychological links is really important, I think. We could talk a lot about, people want to talk about numerology quite a lot and this kind of stuff. I think that's of limited interest to a listener, I think, as a living experience, other than to say that the meaning and that way that he inserts meaning into the piece is only part of the strand of meaning. That what he's really good at is making the music incredibly full of meaning, of all possible kind of interpretations that add layer on layer of meaning and of associations to the story, which of course would have been incredibly familiar to the congregation.
Exactly that. So we've got very familiar texts, although with new music and in the arias, new words, and intended specifically to bring this very familiar story and to give the congregations, the listeners, the opportunity to reflect anew on a story that is overwhelmingly familiar to them.
That's it. It's so important to recognise that this is a story they would have known, I think, the congregation would have known so well. And so the points in both pieces where Bach sort of presses pause, if you like, and says, here's what we're thinking about today, do I think a few things. They firstly allow us to consider a particular element of the story, because the story is so full of possible angles and possible meanings. So we can consider a particular element. And of course, that Bach is responding to the material of the gospel in that way. So he's the things that receive reflection and consideration and meditation in the John Passion are very different to the ones that receive that same treatment in the Matthew. We'll perhaps come to that, the differences later. But the other thing is that it allows music to do what Martin Luther said it could do, which was foster a connection with God, but also a connection among the faithful congregation and among the community, which one imagines was a really important part of the propagation of the religion.
You said earlier that the reaction to this piece when it was first heard was probably not an overwhelmingly positive one, that it was too much. Can you imagine what it must have been like to be there at that first performance?
I sometimes wonder whether it would have been, oh my God, listen to that, or whether they would have just not really been listening, like lots of congregations the world over. But I don't know. I don't think we can know really. But certainly, for those with ears who would hear it, it must have been so striking. You compare the John particularly, it's as a whole particularly, it's so dramatic and so propulsive. Even the musical structure with this, the central chorale, which fans out choruses like a palindrome, gives us this sense of Christ's fate being inevitable, and the music adds to the inexorability of the story, which doesn't happen at all in the Matthew. There's much more, it's much more slowly unfolding, and it feels like a much actually more natural progression of events. But yeah, the violence of the choruses and some of the arias in the John, it really goes beyond, way beyond what was happening in the early part of the 18th century in Germany.
Thank you.
That is Claire Wilkinson and the Dunedin Consort with Simon Jones playing the obbligato violin in Erbarmadich from the Matthew Passion.
Familiar story, yes. And then these moments, extended moments of contemplation and reflection and instruction, if you like, in the arias.
Exactly right. Bach is really interested in what music can do in this way. I think he wants it to teach people, to persuade people, to lead people perhaps to fruitful reflection, contemplation. John Butt says a great thing about the difference between Bach oratorios and Handel operas is that when you watch a Handel opera, your attention is drawn to the stage and to see what the characters on stage are doing. When you listen to a Bach Passion, the main action that happens is actually in the heart and mind of the listener, which I think is a really, really valuable way of approaching this repertoire. It's meant to change people. You're supposed to emerge from a passion, I think, slightly different to the person you went in as, which I think is really valuable. Just one, like, slightly, can I make a geeky point about the construction of that aria?
Let's be honest, this is a niche podcast.
Exactly. So please. Well, here's some niche material coming up. So it's in 12/8 time signature, which is the same time signature as the opening chorus and the same time signature as the final aria, Machadich.
This is the aria that we've just heard.
Erbarmadich, yes. So, which is the Siciliano, or the pastoral meter, which probably refers to the Lamb of God that gets mentioned in the first chorus of the whole piece. So there's a kind of metrical thread running through it. And the bass line of this aria is the same as the what we now call the Passion Chorale. So bum 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 bum. He constructs the bass line from that. So already you've got this sense that he's not really finding new material, Bach. He's just using what's around him. He's so capable of taking things and constructing something incredibly sublime, really, but from things that are already there.
I love it.
It's good, isn't it?
I remember when you first pointed that out to me, actually. It's sort of jaw-dropping moment. It's like, how have I never seen that?
Yeah, it's like sort of hiding in plain sight, but it's there. It always reminds me of that thing that Michelangelo said about David. You know, someone said, this amazing sculpture you've made. I said, I didn't make the sculpture. David was in there. I just found him.
Exactly. I read somewhere recently that Lutherans were taught that they had to read the Bible and meditate and reflect on it and then pray. And I think that's an interesting process. And that is the nub of what the Passions are about, really?
I think so. It's about exactly that, about being closer to God, I think, for them, but also being closer to one's own self and one's own feeling of faith and of love for God, I think. And the music really, particularly in the St. Matthew, I think, really allows time for that, which the John always feels to me. Whenever I sing it, this sounds really silly, really, but whenever I sing the St. John, I always find myself a bit surprised that he's on the cross already.
Yeah.
Because everything happens so quickly and so kind of at this kind of heightened sense of drama and reality. Whereas the Matthew allows so much more time for reflection. I think that's really interesting.
I mean, the chorus is, the pace of the drama is electric in the John. The chorus is there. They're vicious in their condemnation. It's a ferocious role that the crowd have there. Absolutely central to the narrative and part of the action. And there's almost no time for niceties. Just listen to this as we head back to the St. John Passion for a moment. End of a chorale, and then a crunching gear change straight back into the drama.
Thank you.
James Gilchrist evangelising there with the choir of New College Oxford and Collegium Novum, directed by Edward Higginbotham. Nick, you mentioned the central chorale. That's the central chorale in the John Passion.
That's right, and it acts as a sort of musical mirror whereby the next chorus and the previous chorus to it are the same music, and the following chorus and the previous one to that are also made of the same music. The text of the chorale might be worth reflecting on a bit. Durch dein Gefängnis, Gottes, and through your imprisonment, Son of God, is how we attain our freedom. And the final line, which is so beautifully set and really wonderful to sing, denn gingst du nicht die Knechtschaft ein, if you had not gone through slavery, our slavery must have been eternal. So there's this wonderful sense that the meaning of the text also has a real sense of musical importance and musical foundation to the whole piece.
We haven't really mentioned the chorales yet, which are the building blocks, the pillars which run through the pieces. These tunes would have been known to the congregation, and they would have sung them. They were congregational hymns.
That's right. They would have known the tunes for sure. The harmonizations might have been new to them, but one imagines not everybody would have been totally wise to that. I'm not sure. I'm happy to be educated on this. I'm not sure if the congregation would have sung along during the Passion performances themselves, but they certainly would have known the tunes, and they also would have recognized not just the musical material, but the form of a chorale as a point of collective reflection and collective prayer, which I think is a really important, like I say, brick in the construction of these pieces. The more I do these pieces, the more I find the chorales the sort of beating heart of them. I used to find them really boring to rehearse, but the texts are the wonderful text, and also this sense that individuals come together, so they're sort of like an aria, but for the whole ensemble, because of course the orchestra plays as well.
Yeah,
and often we try and get the orchestra to sing along as well, so that there's a real sense of sympathetic resonance of the chorales within the musicians.
So the melodies are familiar to them, the subjects of what the chorales are about,
yeah,
and
the
what
text
they represent.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that for some of the congregation, a two-hour performance of a piece of music, they'd have been drifting off. These chorales would actually have drawn them back into the present.
That's a really good point, yeah, exactly. Because the Matthew particularly is long. That's almost the main thing about it. I'm sure it's absolutely deliberate, but it is a long time. And of course, add in the fact that you have, between part one and part two of these settings, you have a long, hour-long probably sermon by the preacher. And the preacher's in front of the congregation, the musicians in the Thomaskirche behind.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a slight sense that the music arrives in a different way to the word the words that the preacher says. But yeah, it's a long time, and I think these chorales are part of his pacing of the narrative in a way that allows the story to always come back to the listener, to the congregation.
And there, slightly cruelly, we must leave this episode. Nicholas and Eamon conclude their Bach Passion Chat next time.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or, if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.